would love to spend a lot of time with Margot St. James, whose name almost explains her. Margot is a beat chick who lives on Grant Street, who paints, who's writing her autobiography, who knows everybody on the street, is the queen of the street, and is fantastically affable. She's probably Italian, though the name is undoubtedly made up. She came originally from Washington. She's sort of attractive in a wide open, not terribly attractive way. Because she's wide open, a lot of people think there's something wrong with her. And she was framed on a charge of being a prostitute. The police, a man called her at 3 in the afternoon and said, "I understand you give wild parties." And she said, how'd you get my phone number? Her number was unlisted. He said, "Well, I understand you give wild parties." And she said, "Oh, don't be silly." And he said, "Can I come up?" And he said, "Where are you?" She said, "Where are you?" He said, "I'm just downstairs. There's a bar downstairs." And she had people up there. So she said, "Sure, come on up. I told you this story."
Mm-hmm. She told us.
That's right. She told her the story. The man came up. He started talking about price. And she said, "No, I don't want to." And he said, "Well, what about $50? And she said, "Well, I still don't want to." And then he said, "What about your friend?" And he said, "Ask her." And the friend said, "Well, 50, and he put the $50 down on the dresser. And then the friend, who was wearing a zipper sweatshirt, kiddingly, I guess, just moved the zipper an inch, so like this. At that, the guy whistled, began tearing the phone out, and put her under arrest. And since she was sharing the apartment with a friend, she was charged not only with being a prostitute, but also with being a madam, because the apartment was in her name. I went to the trial. She'll tell this whole story.
Yeah.
I went to her trial. The judge, and I took a friend, as a matter of fact. I offered to witness for her, but it's very hard to say to come as a witness and say she is not a prostitute. How do you know a thing like that? Yeah. So all you can say is, to my knowledge. She did have witnesses, a doctor who had bought painting, and his wife who had bought paintings from her. She had, she could prove her income, which is the main, she could prove sources of income other than that. She'd been to college and so on. The judge said, "Why, if you're not, do you associate with beatniks? If you're not a prostitute, why do you live on Grant Street? You know, thousands of people live on Grant Street." And the policeman says that you discussed money with her. Oh, then the policeman said to her, "Do you turn tricks?" And she said, "No." And the judge said, "If you're not a prostitute, how do you know what to turn a trick is?" Which is underworld slang, but it's also in many books. It's been in movies. It's been used all over. Okay, well, she was on bail. It was a first offense. She had no prison record or anything. She was convicted. She's out on bail. She got a job as a bail bondswoman. When she was out on bail, the people she met at the bail bonds office hired her to be as a bail bondswoman. So she was doing that. She was banned by the police. Her previous work, she was a cocktail waitress, head waitress at a place called Pierre's on Broadway. Okay, we'd want to talk to her.
I think that one of the most fabulous places up there is that church, the Baptist church that we went to, the Negro church.
The Emmanuel Baptist Church in the Fillmore district, actually on the edge of Japantown. There's a rickety wooden church which broadcasts a kind of holy rolling Baptist mm-hmm. services. After the war, a Negro named Abner Green, who learned to paint by painting the insignia on trucks and airplanes, came out of the army with the mission to paint the Stations of the Cross. And he found this church, and he got them to let him start painting. And he did these amazing paintings, which are very powerful and impressive, using what looks like show card color.
Almost pop art in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And using a combination of comic strip techniques and the techniques you might get in the religious books that a kid might see, so that the Roman soldiers look like Prince Valiant. And just photographically, these things are marvelous because they're very striking images. He worked on this for 2 years, unpaid, completely unpaid. At the end of the 2 years, there was a lot of the people, the minister of the church got worried. He thought he was going to sue them for money, and there was a big fuss about it, and he eventually ended up in an institution. But for 2 years, he did nothing but paint these things. And now you can go in and see them, and while you look at them, there are services going on. You hear people wailing, and yes, Lord, amen, that kind of thing. And you can see these Christ hanging from the cross. He paints a combination of what he has read about our Lord's Palestine and San Francisco, Galilean women are wearing brassieres. This has been done in Haiti. The Episcopal Cathedral had murals which had the whole story completely transposed to Haiti. In this case, there's a strange combination. And the images are very strong. The heads are almost expressionless, or with comic strip expression. They're not expressionless, but very melodramatic expression. But the distance and the vistas are very feeling. And it's a powerful painting.
And Green is still institutionalized?
I don't know. No one seems to know where he is. Was it the day you were there? I got to talking with one of these old Negro women who said she knew him.
Yeah, you told me, yeah. That he was coming along.
I asked about him. I said, is he back in town? She said, no, he's coming along real fine. Well, where is he now? Oh, he's fine. Well, is he coming back to San Francisco? Real soon he'll be coming. I mean, she really didn't know very much about him, but she knew somebody had got. I heard from him. No, I didn't get a letter from him. A friend of mine got a letter from him. Who's that? Well, it's a friend of mine. She didn't really, but she did have some knowledge. What you could trace him down. Pierre Delattre, who ran he's someone you'd want to talk to, who ran the Bread and Wine Mission, the Mission to the Beats, which was sponsored by the Congregationalist Church. He is a minister. It was he who first took me there. He had a painting by Abner Green, a non-religious painting, in his house. He has weddings once in a while. These beatniks get married, and he has an altar built out of orange crates.
His name is
Pierre Delattre. He's a minister. He's also a theater director. He has a little theater now, which you might want to visit, in an old church, which is, again, the money for it is put up by the American Council.
He's also a Negro?
No, he's white. He's American of French descent.
Let's spell that name out so the stenographer.
Pierre, P-I-E-R-R-E, Delattre, D-E-L-A-T-T-R-E. He's related to Delattre de Tassigny, the great French general.
Have you given any thought since earlier today about what possible form, aside from a walk through the city that a day, start in the morning at the places that you might be interesting in the morning, deserted versus the nightlife. I think the nightlife is very interesting, especially the nightlife that tourists, for example, might not know about or might know only incidentally about. The committee, for example, we talked about the possibility of doing a part of the film on the committee, not only the place itself, but backstage. When they're preparing their improvisations, when they're preparing the scenes that they do right there.
I think it would be a good idea to do a scene either before or after, as they really do it, showing what they can do, and then to show them working on it, or maybe show them working on a scene and then show the finish. There is a sense about San Francisco which is special, which is one of the reasons I love it, which is that it is a community. Mm-hmm. It's almost a village culture. Mm-hmm. It's like Port-au-Prince, or it's like maybe 19th century Paris. Mm-hmm. It's small. You can walk, as you know. You may get tired, but you can walk from almost any point of the city to any other point. I've walked the furthest way you can walk, and it's a long walk, but it's not an impossible thing. Which means that if you go for a walk every day, as I do, or two walks every day, one in the afternoon, one in the evening, you can't help knowing hundreds of people that you do, just because you see them frequently. And they talk about you, you talk about them, you talk to each other, you have a sense of relating to them, but you can almost not get in any other American city except a true village.
Yeah. Maybe
this is a thing which, especially if you live alone as I do, is a tremendous comfort. The sense that you have a community that's part of it, that you are a part of. I can walk out at night, as I guess I said to you, if I feel alone at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, too late to call a friend. You can't telephone, but I can take a walk and I can look through there, in my neighborhood or within 5 minutes. I can look to 6 or 7 windows. If the light's on, I can throw a stone at the window and say, you want to come out for a walk? And I can tempt someone out for a walk because I can say, do you want to go to North Beach? Do you want to go to the wharf? Do you want to go to downtown? Do you want to go to Market Street? Leo used to be fascinated by Market Street, which is kind of low life, and the sailors and the Nickelodeons the quarter movies.
That's another element to it, which would be very interesting, is the fact not only is this a community, but that the artistic community of San Francisco is quite a close one, in the sense that all of the writers, most of you know each other, you're running into each other, you see each other, you play frisbee in the park.
There aren't too many writers, really. If you think of frisbee, there are only a couple of, there's only Leo and me, really.
What's frisbee?
It's a game with a plastic disc that you throw in the air and you leap gracefully and bird-like and you catch it. And it's scored, according to George Leonard, it's a morality metaphor. It's the only game that's scored according to how hard you tried. And so you have to score your points against you by how hard you try. It's a very curious game and a great deal of fun.
Is it played anywhere else?
It was invented there, but George Leonard is a proselytizer. He's the West Coast editor of Look. And every place he goes in the world, he carries frisbees and he proselytizes. So there's a group that plays down here, some Look people and some journalists and radio television people. And there's a group that plays in Central Park, and the thing has spread. There's been talk about a national, about Newsweek or Life or Look doing a...
I have a story I'm working on now called Don't Turn It Off, called Frisbee in the Park.
But it's a community of fairly lively, inventive people. It's not a community of writers. For example, Jerry Fagan, who is a surgeon, a ventriloquist. You go to his house and you find architects painting a ventriloquist. He's an amateur ventriloquist, so the professional ventriloquist, whenever they're in town, and the one who does a child's program on radio station, they all gather at his place. And he's professionally a proctologist, so he talks art, literature, culture, ventriloquy, Khrushchev, ban the bomb, and then he takes out your piles. He's been removing the piles of the best people in town.
But struck me was, for example, the last time I was up there, I went to play tennis, I came back, and there was Barnaby Conrad and his brother sitting there. Just dropped in, that there is a kind of continual inflow. I mean, it is that, you know, Barnaby Conrad because, you know, name dropping, but the sense that people run into each other. When I was up and we'd walk over to the actor's workshop and just, you know, go in, say hello, out for coffee afterwards, talk, more walking, you know. This sense of rhythm, the rhythm of the life is very, very...
The afternoon life is wonderful. We either left town or were working in the afternoon, but you go down to Washington Park, which is very much like Washington Square in New York. People lying, it happens to be a place where a lot of interracial couples go, where a lot of the beatniks go, but where a lot of the, it's in an Italian neighborhood. So there are the children, there are the beards with their sketch pads or their books. There are the lovemaking couples. There's a lot of people from the Actors Workshop live around there. Kathy Ross lives around there. Susan Darby lives around there. And it's in front of this rather interesting church with the two spires. Mm-hmm. Or you go to the committee where they have acting classes in the afternoon and you watch these people work in this extraordinarily beautiful room with skylights. I've always wanted to take a camera there, and I'm not a camera. I don't own a camera. But the committee people, some of them are quite talented, and they're doing second companies of this improvisation mm-hmm. theater, and they have acting classes, and they work, and a lot of it is very effective. There's a great deal of construction going on now, so there are visually spectacular things, whole sides of Russian Hill being carved out for skyscrapers to.
Oh, you talked also, right, mentioned the Russian Hill. Reminds me of the, you talked about talking to the Russians.
There are two Russian communities in town. One is on Petrero Hill, which is a beautiful old hill, which looks like a village, where land is still relatively cheap. And it's almost general stores. It's right in the city. Again, it's within walking distance of Market Street. But it's on the other side, the unchic side of Market Street, with wonderful views, unfortunately.
Well, it's on the south side of Market Street.
That's right, south of Market. Unfortunately, there's a slight smell of linseed oil, and with the wind is right, of the butcher, of the
slaughterhouses.
But there's a Russian community there, which looks almost like their Russian church is painted, just funny little colors. And there are Russian babas on the street, and there are Russian bakeries and Russian restaurants. Then there's another Russian settlement on Clement Street where there are about six or seven Russian restaurants and bakeries, and the signs are in Russian. There's a Russian newspaper published. There's a French newspaper published in San Francisco. There's also it's the biggest French colony outside of New York in the mm-hmm. United States. That's a whole other question of what we talked about Fillmore.
Yeah.
You walk from Fillmore, from the marina, where it begins at a yachting basin, and it's very elegant, through Pacific Heights, which is where the street is lined with beautiful homes. And a little further on, it becomes Harlem and Japantown and the very tiny remnants of McAllister, of a ghetto, Jewish ghetto. But there are just a few shops and a synagogue. Within 20 minutes, you go through six different nationalities, including black. You go from the Japanese to the black Muslims to the Negroes to the Jews. Mm-hmm. What about something like the disappearing village? Because what's happened, and even in the few years I've been there, is that it's becoming very, very rapidly like Manhattan, growing vertically, expanding very rapidly. The population not, but the pressure is
the traffic jam that we ran into trying to stop and get my kids a little toy on the way to the airport really is fantastic. Like it's really New York, and it is, the streets aren't wide.
Yeah. He had the same intensity about getting the kids something as he had about finding those photographs. You know, there was nothing you could, there was no way of diverting him. I thought of running him over, but you still, if you leave the centers, there still is, you can show the contrast, because you just go a few blocks away, and then you have the kind of tennis idlers. There's a street life, benches, the old cracked tile benches with memorial plaques to George Sterling, poet laureate of 19th century San Francisco. Or you go out to Sutro Palace, or to the beach, where the surfers.
Right. You did describe Sutro Palace.
It's a monstrous player piano of a building all made of Tiffany glass with strange museums, old coins, memorabilia of old San Francisco, photographs, old automobiles. There's no particular rhyme or reason. It's like an enormous junk shop, antique shop, and this great ice skating rink where I skated, which has marvelous it looks like the building. I didn't see the Orson Welles movie, but I know the building in which it was shot. It's an enormous high roof building with light mm-hmm. coming in. And though it's California and it's reasonably warm, there is an indoor ice skating rink there, and very few people seem to use it, and about a third of them seem to have decided to skate when they're drunk. So that it's a very, I like to ice skate, I grew up on ice skating. And so it's very odd. It's a wonderful date. You say to a girl, let's go ice skating. And she immediately says, I haven't skated since I was a child. And you say, that's all right, I'll hold you up. And that's already the beginning.
There also the Art Institute or the School of
That's
Art.
Almost my favorite building.
Yeah. Describe, can you remember the day we went there? It was very rainy. Remember when I was up? It rained all the time, very foggy and overcast. It was between terms. And the sense of the footsteps echoing up the stairs in those halls and the kind of desertion of it, the sense of tremendous amount of activity that had been going on, you know, while we weren't there. And outside, what was interesting was that on the rest of the land that wasn't covered by building, it was like an old vacant lot with kind of things thrown out, you know, an old sink.
That was sculpture, my friend.
No, it was an old plumbing.
Yeah.
It was an old sink.
Yeah.
The grass was growing high and tufts are very...
It was pop sculpture.
Yeah, there was some of that. There are, it's, and there were also those wonderful trees, eucalyptus mm-hmm. trees growing. Mm-hmm. The building is quite old, though not really old, but in scale. But it's maybe 55 or 60 years old, but it's modeled on Southern European, kind of half-bastard Romanesque style. And it's built on the lower side of Russian Hill and has 14 levels. It's not a high building, but because it's built on the hill, you're constantly going upstairs and downstairs. And there's a crenellated tower where you can stand up there with your arrows and shoot the... And there are parts of it that are condemned. They're rebuilding it. The whole building has the feeling of a European art school. There's a courtyard in the middle with a tile fountain. I've been there when they've had Dixieland bands at the end of the semester.
It's a functioning art
school. Oh, yeah. It's the California School of Art, School of Fine Arts. No. There's a library. It's a very bad library, but a beautiful room that was probably, I think it was originally a mansion. And it was probably some kind of banquet room. Now it's a library, and there are old sprung leather couches. And you come in there, and there are always people sleeping on the couches, in addition to doing the reading. There's a cafeteria downstairs, which I think of as the brainwash room.
Talk a little bit more, excuse me, Clint.
Because it's so loud, the noise, there's so much babble in it.
In terms of this possibility for a theme of the vanishing village, the vanishing small... Not only in the business district, which we know, you know, it's common to every city.
Well, the city has no, it's not going to disappear under the weight of industry, because the city, because of its situation, will never have a lot of industry. But it's going to be a product of money, prosperity, and leisure. It's a place where people are going to go who have money for one reason or another, because they can do their work at a distance like writers and artists can, or because they've inherited money, or because they've saved money, or because, like a lot of people, a lot of the doctors I know say, I was practicing in New York, I was making $40,000 a year, I'd rather make $20,000 here and play tennis every day, all year round. But so the city will fill up with culture lovers, which means a lot of homosexuals, a lot of artists, a lot of romantic kids. The old San Franciscans say that the pretty girls, that the girls from Bennington and let's say Reed and the smart and Hollins College, the smart girls' colleges, the very intelligent, driving, ambitious ones go to New York and the very pretty ones come to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. That's a gross exaggeration. But the romantic ones come to walk, to trip down the flowered paths, to walk down McIndray Alley.
But then, remember when we took that long walk with Leo through the old market produce section, which is now being turned from the produce section, which is moved way out by near the Cow Palace, is now being turned into luxury apartments overlooking the Embarcadero and the that drive. You know. This whole idea of the changeover from commerce, from some kind of trade, from some kind of concept of that to the leisure is something that can be.
Around the corner where I lived, there was a section of the hill which was vacant. There was just outcropping of rock and grass, and it had never been built on. And the kids used to play in it, and also down the hill nearby, there were a bunch of Chinese kids who had made sorts of sleds of crates on roller skates, and I used to see them every day, and they would play war, and they'd roll down the hill and really careen, it's very dangerous, on these little soapbox machines. Well, a few months ago, the truck started coming day after day after day, carrying away the hill, and now they're building a 26-story apartment there. We went to a place called Miyako in Japantown, in Canada, where we gave our order. We sat in these little booths. There's a jukebox that plays Japanese rock and roll records. And then suddenly there was a great babble and excitement in the kitchen. And the word, the only English word we heard, was movie star, finally. And they came out all with their asking Jack to autograph the menus. And then he turned around and he asked the one who was most, I guess it was our waitress, to autograph. He asked her to autograph. So she gave us her autograph.
That's a fascinating place to explore from this point of view, across from that church, and across and very close to the street where that Miyako restaurant is, was absolutely at that time leveled for a whole new housing development. You know?
Which is, it's been leveled for several years. Yeah. And it's been stopped.
And of course, another thing which will change the city will be the new transportation system, the subway.
When they get it built. The thing that will really finish the city as it is known now, and oddly enough, will be the day, which is inevitable, when we start trading with Red China, which has to happen. And in fact, the group of businessmen, which the president has more or less encouraged to make contact with the Red Chinese, is mostly San Francisco. And, you know, the day that it's admitted that we're going to exchange, you know, at first medicine or little tiny, you know, the day that begins with Red China, or the day the rumor gets in the paper, everybody who owns land in downtown San Francisco is going to double the price, and everything's going to start building. It's going to make an enormous difference. Because, as Bill Hogan said this to me before he came to San Francisco to live, he said San Francisco will be the New York of the 20th century. I don't think he realizes that we're not in the 19th century anymore. But it will be the great, when we trade with Red China and with China, and Japan gets more and more important, it will be the great port for a great part of America's trade.
Because there's a port now, it's pretty dead.
Pretty dead, pretty quiet. There are other things which are still visible, but barely visible, like the Barbary Coast, which mostly Pacific and Jackson, which was 100 years ago the place where the Sydney Ducks came, the ex-cons from the exiled Australian con. It was where the word Shanghai was originated, because they hit sailors off the head and put them on, sell them to captains with ships bound for Shanghai, where the girls, the prostitutes in the bars were known as pretty waiter girls. These places are, these dives are still visible. That is, they're not doing that anymore. But the murals, the paintings, the decoration is still there, except the actual place is now an interior decorator's shop.
Oh, you mean the place which used to be the international...
Which used to be, that's right.
Called the International Settlement.
That's right.
Oh, I deplore it.
The change?
The change.
Well, actually, the same places still exist, but
I know,
not the same,
but
they're elsewhere.
They're so chic now. And so.
Well, no, there's the Tenderloin still.
But I mean, that block called the International Settlement was an incredible place to see.
It occurred to me it might be interesting, just for some kind of background, to go into your own background, Herb, a little bit. The fact that you have worked as the city planner in Detroit, and was it Detroit?
Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
Cuyahoga.
And, you know, these kind of related to this peculiar combination of, peculiar in the sense of unique, combination of qualities in Herb himself that would make this particular view of San Francisco such an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
That he brings not only an artistic and cultural point of view towards us, but also an awareness of history, an awareness of social change very strongly.
so. But
when I was in Cleveland, I worked for nearly a year. One of my favorite projects was to try to get the city to try out blocking one street, one short street, against traffic in downtown. So that this would be, it would be encouraged then that this street become a place where people stroll, where they stop and talk, where there would be a cafe. And it was a block of, that you could walk the length of in maybe 5 minutes mm-hmm. at a normal brisk pace or 10 minutes strolling. But this was, to do this would be, you know, the crime of les automobile. I mean, this was where you would have to require a revolution. You can't do this because Chevrolet has a plant in Cleveland, and if you propose this, immediately you have all the automobile people against you. So the result is that in my hometown, Cleveland, where the area of which has about 2 million people, quite a lot bigger than the Bay Area, there's no place to walk. There's no real walking place. Mm-hmm. Where there's a community culture. There's a tiny Chinatown, but very tiny. There's a tiny Greek town in Detroit. But there is no real place where you meet a variety of people. But all of San Francisco, almost, not all, Russian Hill, Telegraph Hill, Knob Hill, Potrero Hill, the Marina, and all these areas put together are really places where people can live without automobiles and where they can live on outside on foot. They can sing folk songs, they can go to folk song singing places, they can find French bars, Italian bars, German bars, Japanese bars, Chinese bars. It's very much like the European city, which wasn't planned to be without an automobile, but which is just naturally grew up without the automobile.
Maybe talk a little bit now about the music, the jazz, and is it any kind of a center for?
It's been a center for reactionary jazz, mm-hmm. and to some extent for progressive jazz. There are a lot of jazz
Although
places.
The two most famous places just closed.
Which?
Blackhawk.
I think it's being moved. It's not closed.
And the place, there was another place that had progressive jazz.
Coffee Gallery. There are a couple of places that are still
Which also closed.
The Blackhawk, I think, is just going to move. I don't think it's closed. At least it was announced that it was going to be someplace else. But there are always... I've heard a great deal of jazz since I've been there. There are, I don't know how many clubs that play progressive jazz, in addition to the fact that they're the old timers. A lot of the Dixieland musicians have settled there. I went with Saroy and to Earthquake Magoons, because this is the music he remembered from the time he wrote Young Man on the Flying Trapeze about San Francisco when he was a kid there. You can still... He visits. He spends a month a year there. He's there right now. We were walking down that old market section, and at 12 o'clock at night, we walked into a cigar factory where there were a couple of guys rolling cigars and bought cigars, hand-rolled cigars right then. I don't think there are many cities in this country where you can do that. New York has a life 24 hours. But I know of no other city in the United States that does. Bookshops, you can go and buy Partisan Review at 3 in the morning.
We walked on our way down, on our way to Chinatown for dinner at 8 or 8:30 in the evening, and there we walked past that sweatshop of Chinese ladies in there on their sewing machines.
And these Chinese sweat, photographically, they're marvelous because all through Chinatown, I think there are something like 10 or 12,000, according to the statistics, 10 or 12,000 women working in these sweatshops, which are like old storefronts. And you can recognize them. They have them blocked, their shades, so you can't look in. You can open the door and look in, or you can peek under the shades, but they're somewhat disguised. But there's one way of recognizing them, which is that there's always a cluster of children up front, because all the women take their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see 10 or 12 kids, so visually it's marvelous because you see a bunch of children playing in front of a store and you don't know why. Then you poke the lens in and you see a and you see lines of sewing machines and women working on sweaters or blouses. Hmm? They find all kinds of ways of evading the minimum wage in Chinatown. The result is that you can eat very, very cheaply. You can get a meal for what we ate, with not ordering the special, ordering the most expensive thing on the menu. That for the two of us, it was about $3, $3.50. And, you know, just ordering the dishes we liked. And you can buy things very cheaply. And you go into these alleys that we looked at, Waverly Place, where there will be a little Chinese bar, a little Chinese radio station, a little Chinese...
Who are some of the other people you think we might be able to, or you might be able to talk to in relation to...
Depends on how you...
To this film.
Depends on how you see it. If you want to talk to people who are important in the community, you could talk to people like Mai Tai Singh, who's sort of an actress and who owns a bar. She's a very beautiful ex-model Chinese woman. And her brother Tom, who speaks Yiddish and French and a lot of other languages and is vaguely literary. You talk to Bob Patterson, who is a writer and a criminal, served 17 years in prison, has published 5 or 6 books, wrote the book that Brute Force was based on, also wrote the movie. You talk to Herb Cain, Barnaby Conrad, Erskine Caldwell, Don Kingman, Pierre Latre if you want to, Bishop Pike if you want to. There are people like that. I mean, there are people of some national renown if you want that, or if you want the typical... If you want people who are typical citizens of San Francisco, then if I were to say the names, that wouldn't mean anything.
Herb Blau, what about Herb?
Herb Blau, the actress, would you talk to various of the actors or the directors? There's a Catholic university, there's San Francisco State. If you leave the boundaries of San Francisco, the town itself, there are a number of universities.
Yeah, well, I think we'd have to probably confine ourselves.
Could talk to the Muni Man of the Month, the bus driver.
This is another very interesting. Tell about this, the largest literary prize, and you know, just recently, it's the largest amount of money.
Yeah, a man who owns Ruth Atkins. Does that store exist down here?
No.
It's a chain of clothing stores, and I think there are 26 branches. Immensely large enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Their advertising bill per year is $1,500,000 just for advertising. The man who owned it had this strange idea of endowing a literary prize, an idea that was planted. And he's giving, I'm one of the judges, I'm the chairman of the committee of judges. He's giving $5,000 a year to a writer, not a San Francisco writer, not a California writer, a writer. This October, I think it's October 6th, there's going to be a banquet at which about 50, to give you an idea of how many writers there are, 50 Bay Area, San Francisco writers are going to be invited. There'll be a Dixieland band playing. Nelson Algren is being brought in to give the presentation speech, and the writer who won, who's from New England, as a matter of fact, will be flown in, and he will be given a check for $5,000, which is larger than the Pulitzer Prize, larger than the National Book Award, larger than any other literary prize. And something
for published work?
For published work. Something in this man who has finished the 8th grade in education and somehow managed to find himself owner of this enormous department store impelled him to want to express himself by endowing this kind of prize. I think it's no accident that this happened in San Francisco. I don't think it would happen to the owner of a department store in Cleveland or Boston or Baltimore or Miami. It has to do with the fact that in the Bay Area there are four newspapers which have daily book columns. That's more than New York. They happen to be even worse in quality than New York, but San Francisco has a major kind of interest.
Sure, and there's many universities and colleges in the area.
There are three major museums. None of them are as good as they would be if they all three were put together, but there are three heavily endowed museums. One of them exceptionally beautifully situated, the one with the golden
Palace of the Legion of Honor. Yeah. Well, the Young Museum isn't badly situated either.
The building is not very good. Yeah. It's in the park, but the Palace of the Legion of Honor has that wonderful view of the ocean.
Yes.
And the beach, the seals.
That's the one in the park, in Golden Gate Park.
That's the De Young in Golden Gate Park.
Oh.
The palace is out by the sea.
Can you can you suggest a tentative title which would embody in some way?
What about something like this? It just occurred to me as we were talking: San Francisco, the Vanishing Village.
Or maybe a little more personal, since it would involve you, put you in the picture. I think it's very interesting, Herb, that you've lived in New York and Cleveland and Detroit, that you have spent some time in Haiti as a semi-sociologist. Am I correct?
Well, I was supposed to be studying Haiti.
Yeah. You lived in Israel and have lived, you know, you've spent time in Paris, that you then arrive at San Francisco with a cosmopolitan view of the world and of cities.
The thing which, it's not a cliche, because only I have used it, but I've said it so often to friends to explain why I like the town so much. It's forever April land. It's always April. And there's always a feeling of tentativeness and of something about to happen. And of where I grew up in Cleveland, the closest I could get to the feeling of San Francisco is the spring. It's always, the flowers are, well, you in Southern California are used to that too, but there's that sweet smell. There's no industry. So there's no dust on the street lamps. There's a certain brightness in the town. It has to do with the fact that the paint doesn't discolor in the same way. The bulbs are not shaded. You're used to a certain shading of light from street lamps, which comes from the fact that there's coal dust or soot on bulbs. You don't have that in San Francisco. You always have that wind coming through the Golden Gate, sweeping the city clean. From my apartment, as you saw, Oakland was brown with fog, and it was clear and clean where we were.
It occurred to me in your comparing and contrasting and whatnot, you know, this city in your talk here with other cities, and, you know, that something along the lines of why choose San Francisco, why San Francisco, in a sense also historically, you know, what is the excuse for San Francisco? What is the reason for San Francisco? We know that it's a port. I think, again, to explore this area and what is happening then to San Francisco, what is the future for a city of this sort? And in a sense, an anachronism. A city where people live on hills, where there are buildings with 14 levels. A European community, in a very real sense, certainly a cosmopolitan community, where in the midst of it, 50 writers from a radius of 25 miles can come to a dinner.
Or you could say, yeah, that's sort of accident. The thing, in New York, when I lived in New York, one tended to know only writers. Mm-hmm. But in San Francisco, I go to dinner and Harry Bridges is opposite me. Mm-hmm. Or Mortimer J. Adler, he's recently left. Or doctors, or
Jacobs,
Paul Jacobs, ex-labor skates, wild men of all varieties. It's a city where you don't have to think about either opening or shutting the window. You can really get about your business. The weather, the problems of transportation, the problems of belonging are almost solved, where you don't have to belong. There are no highly defined neighborhoods, except there are for racial groups. But and for many, many years, the Chinese were confined to Chinatown. And now, and it's happened very, very fast, the racial barrier for the Chinese, at least, is nearly down. And the Chinese are going out in all directions. The Japanese, and it happened to the Japanese earlier than for the Chinese, because the Japanese wanted to get out, and the Chinese had their family organizations and didn't really want the door to be open after it was open. Now, of course, they are learning to live that way. There's another interesting line about the city, which might even be a good title for it, is something I was talking to an old San Franciscan. I was asking, why is it that their very race problems are very simple there. There's very relatively little. And why is it that society is so mixed and the social register is so much less exclusive than it is anyplace else? And he said, nobody came first. The Chinese, the Germans, the Jews, the Irish, the Australians, the old Americans, they all came in 1849.
The gold came first.
All came. Yeah, but nobody came first. In 1847, the population of San Francisco was something like 500. 2 years later, it was something like 70,000. And the city would burn down every 2 years. The total city would burn down every 2 years. And then in 6 months, it would be built up bigger than before. It seemed to be the fumigation method. They'd burn the city down every few years. And there was so much, since they were all there, the city was almost a tent, and it was built of the crates that they shipped in.
That is a good title. Nobody came first.
Yeah, it's a good title.
Nobody came to San Francisco first, if you want to get San Francisco. Or San Francisco, : nobody came first.
San Francisco is hay fever. I sound like a booster now. You could, despite what people say about the fog, I think it's clean. It's a fog that cleans the nasal passages. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't. I don't think there's much respiratory trouble there.
Except when the smog finally hits it.
There isn't very. We were there the other day, and there was smog. But there's been, and there is a problem increasing.
Yes, it's.
There is increasing.
It isn't only with San Francisco. It's increasing.
Yeah. But there isn't very much smog yet, and in San Francisco you don't have. There's another thing, which is that. You don't have any climate in San Francisco. You have a whole set of weathers. If the smog is downtown, you don't have it up in Russian on the hills. If it's foggy in Pacific Heights, the sun is shining beyond Divisadero Street. In fact, I was told that Divisadero Street was named because it's the division between the foggy area and the sunny area. If you look in the ads for houses, they will say sunny. And that's very often true. It's a place where there are many areas of town where there's just never any fog. It's odd that the chic areas of town have a lot of fog because they're by the ocean or near the bay. North Beach never has fog, maybe 3 or 4 days a year. The town has it's curious that with this cultural interest and with a high degree of education, with a very high percentage of college graduates. It has a very corrupt and backward city administration, which means mm-hmm. that it has the highest number of bars, I think, in the United States per capita.
It has the highest alcoholism.
Highest alcoholism.
And highest suicide.
Everybody's. But the there are lots of reasons. There are lots of explanations. This, it doesn't mean the city is bad. It means that everybody, it's the furthest point west. In other words, people who are running away from themselves, they keep going, well, I'll escape, I'll go there, I'll go there, I'll go there, and they finally get as far as they can go, and the next stop is the Golden Gate Bridge. Funny thing about the suicides, there's been a study of that, of those who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. Very few of them jump away from the land. They almost all jump toward the land. If they're jumping towards security, they don't jump out to the open ocean. They're always on the, almost all of them are on the side toward the ocean.
Maybe that's because the water is so cold.
Well, on both sides it's pretty cold. You can watch. Another thing which would be visually very interesting is just within, again, walking distance of where I live, Fisherman's Wharf, to get up early in the morning and watch the fishing boats come in, or if you're at the right time of the year, the crab boats.
And then there's Alcatraz.
No more.
No, but I say it's the rock is still there, yeah. And the building is on it. And Pierre de Lattre would be able to tell you something of a man's chances in the water, because he swims that...
That's right. There's a swim. Yeah. Down by the aquatic park, there's a club of mostly businessmen and local people who swim every day of the year, all winter long. And then they celebrate the coming of spring by a swim. It's a yearly event, which they swim from aquatic park, isn't it? Sausalito, do you remember where it is? Archer Alcatraz.
I don't know what exactly. No, it's a they long swim the whole bay.
They swim the bay anyway. And Pierre de Lattre, who's this minister we were talking about, what did it was? He came in, was it 49th or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know, but he had a little trophy for it.
That's a pretty long swim in that water of that temperature. Well, the bay is.
Pretty cool.
It's cool. It's not quite as cool.
They train for it by swimming. Yeah. You can apparently can build up. I used to see him sometimes. The first time I think I saw him on a cable car coming home after that swimming. God, he looked as if he was a neon tube, just glowing. There's a whole area of town which I don't think you've seen. We smelled it once. San Francisco is the biggest coffee roasting
center. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I'm obsessed.
And there's the whole area with
tons. That's something we can't get on.
Can't get the smell.
Oh, I mean, that's
no smell-o-vision.
It's hard to make it work. We'd have to get a vision.
Get a coffee sponsor.
But it's a marvelous thought. It's walking down.
Another thing to visit would be Takahashi, which is a very chic and elegant, magnificent Japanese department store. Very tastefully. Next time you're there, we must go there.
Where is that?
It's
is it
on. No, it's a traditional thing. It's on, I think, Front or Main Street department store, but almost entirely Japanese import, but elegant Japanese things. I know the daughter of the owner of it, whose name is Masako Takahashi. She's a guitar playing beatnik. Very beautiful. Wears Victorian costumes, you know. They took her out when she arrived in high leather boots and a great felt hat, very elegant. And she looks very Japanese. Well, she is Japanese and very beautiful, but talks beat talk. She'd be someone you'd want to talk to. This contrast of a very beautiful Oriental girl, and you say to her, where'd you go to school? And she'll say, man, I went to Bard College. I was the second person ever to be expelled from Bard College. Why? Oh, I made it with a professor of English. So what are you going to do this summer? I think I'll go to Japan. Have a look around. But she's a painter. There's another friend of mine, a Chinese lawyer, whose name is Zeppelin Wong, which gives you an idea of how old he is. He's one of the patrons of the Actors Workshop. His name is Zeppelin Wong. I think it was through him that I met Bernard Petrie.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's always Banducci.
Ah, there's always Banducci, who's a very amusing guy. Well, you saw when we ran into him, he said, how come you haven't been walking lately? I used to pick him up at the eye, and we'd go for a walk. And he'd tell me his life story. It's just a very sad story. But he's now the king of North Beach. He owns a lot of property. He just sold his yacht and bought an airplane. Bought a ranch. He's making a lot of money. And he plays the violin, and he wanted to be a violinist. The man who
still wear a beret?
Yeah, wears a beret and a sweater. He was put in prison a while back because, or in jail, because he testified in court and wouldn't wear a tie. wouldn't take off his beret. He doesn't like being bald. The man that started the Hungry Eye with him was Big Daddy, Eric Nord.
Yes, I've met Eric Nord.
Who was recently working at Mike's place, which Enrico now owns, as a bartender. So this man whose empire started with a partnership later on, it was like Sears hiring Roebuck to work as an accountant.
For a while, he was known as the King of the Beats, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was in a movie, as a matter of fact, where he played the King of the Beats. The Coexistence Bagel Shop went out of existence, and it's now a dress shop. A writer's San Francisco, or an artist's San Francisco. Then you could still use me. My name could still be mentioned, but it would be San Francisco from the point of view of...
You see the city in terms of possibilities, not as a place to rest from the, you know, the wearisome, necessary from the cares of the, you know, New York, or as a final place, you know, for retirement and ease and cheap living, but as a place where you can live with all the benefits of a city and with relatively few of the inconveniences, no, the rush. This, my sense of where you live as being so isolated and yet so close, isolated from and close to the commerce, you know, that you dip down the hill, you go a few blocks south, and bang, you're in the middle of a Wall Street traffic jam.
That's right. It's strange that I live where there's, you know, no traffic at all. Flowers growing, vine-covered walls.
Beneath you. Yeah.
That's right. But even the streets around, that means that the streets around have no traffic. And there are vines and flowers and roses and so on. And you walk, you don't have to call your broker. You walk four blocks down, and there are signs saying, you know, up plus 0.47 Dow Jones averages, or you can walk into any of the brokerage offices there, and there they are. San Francisco is a city where people walk up the hills or down the hills backwards so as not to miss the views. Uh-huh. And there are people there who, you know, it's to me it's an astonishment. There are old people in my neighborhood who will continually comment about the beauty of the area, though they may have lived there 50 years. The late afternoon when you look out of that porch of mine, you asked, in fact, if there were fires. It looks as if the whole of Berkeley is aflame. We were a little late that day, but a little earlier. Every window is reflecting.
The interesting thing is, for example, in the entryway of your apartment and of the one next door that is owned by the same, the decorative, the woman has taken it and painted little designs, and there's a lot of handwork. I get the sense that this city is full of handcraft. And not in the sense, you know, not like Greenwich Village, 8th Street, where, you know, there's those neon-lit sandals, you know.
Something I didn't take you to see, which would be very good, if we want to talk with a series of people of San Francisco types, like Margot St. James, there's a man named Phil Elliott, who was a student of one of the Eames, I think of Eames, the famous furniture maker. And he has a factory down near the wharf, a shop, on a little street that has an outdoor cafe. On the edges of the Italian settlement. Mm-hmm. Fishermen living, and he has his factory. And the kids who want to work with their hands, who are vaguely beat, come in there and will work for a while until they get to doing something else. In fact, Pierre de Lattre, who was a minister, was his partner for a while. He decided he wanted to do carpentry, wanted to work with his hands. And this man takes orders, makes cabinets, and invented a little chair, which cost plus sells.
The Eames chair.
Well, but no, this is his own design, a little stool, really. And I go down there at 12:30, I can have lunch. You can have anybody who shows up at 12:30 gets lunch. Move out into the alley in the sun with an orange crate, and he spreads a tablecloth on it, and inside the orange crate he has organically grown honey organically secreted cheese, organic bread, you know, the whole, and he's a furniture, a typical furniture maker in that respect. He's a health food faddist, and the food is very good, organically grown dates. He lives in a loft. There are quite a few lofts, if you want to get into lofts, to watch artists at work.
Mm-hmm, they're still, so they're still there.
The fact is that despite the expansion of the city, as you saw there, it's easy to get an apartment. The city is not growing. The population of the city is not growing very fast at all. And what's happening is something like what's happened in Manhattan. The very poor stay in town, and the very rich stay in town. The luxury apartments, the new apartments, there are new apartments going up, condominium apartments, which sell for as much as, there's one that sells, the penthouse sells for $170,000. You have to do a lot of living to spend that much in rent or in housing. You'd want to see City Lights, which you know, City Lights Bookshop, which is which is still got the decorations from the days it was a revivalist church. You'd want to visit Station J, which is an old PG&E station that's been made into a huge cavern. You might want to go to Jimbo's Bop City, which is a jazz place that opens at 2 in the morning. I think it probably only serves coffee and breakfast and eggs, but a lot of jazz musicians go.
And then there are a couple of old-time elegant, well, those are well-known, aren't they?
You mean like Ernie's? And
like Ernie's. And
yeah.
So on.
Yeah.
But that's...
There are, well, you
know, Hitchcock took care of Ernie's.
Yeah. But Andy's Lookout, which is a place where fishermen go, it would be nice to do with...
The new motels are...
The dialer room. That's,
are, know, kind of, are kind of weird.
Yeah.
In my search for a place to stay the other day, I wandered into a motel called Villa...
Villa Roma, the Villa dialer room. That's the one that's shaped like a telephone dial.
And I walked into the lobby. And according to the information, published information about this place, the cheapest room is $18. So that's not a cheap place. I walked in and the whole lobby seemed to have been taken over by Beats. It was weird. It was strangest thing I'd ever seen. Now, maybe that was just...
Maybe they were picketing.
Accidental. No, they were sitting there. There was one girl in a leather jacket trying to feed a
Right near there, there's a place, if it ever comes up again, called Executive Suites, which has special rates for writers, artists, and it's very elegant, too. And show people, all the people from The Hungry Eye go there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, but there are little kitchens, little apartments.
Executive Suites?
I think that's what it's called. It's at Hyde and Beach, right near the Buena Vista.
What about the place that's, the motel that's down the street from you on Broadway?
I mean, down in North Beach.
Yeah, on the same side of the street.
Just a motel.
I see.
Right near it, there's this wonderful old hotel, which is, I think, run by Chinese, but it's called the Colombo. It may be owned by Italians, but run by Chinese. The desk clerk there is a poet who's published a number of books of poetry in Chinese and done translations into English. There's a marvelous map of old San Francisco, and there's a newspaper reading room.